All right, guys, we want to welcome everybody to the call once again and thank everybody for submitting all their questions. This is Ryan again with MuscleGainingExperts.com, and we're here tonight with Dave Whitley. And Dave is a performing strongman, a kettlebell expert. Let me read your full bio here, Dave. Kind of screwing this up because my computer is going slow. Dave is a senior instructor in the RKC, the original and leading kettlebell instructor certification founded by Pavel Kotsalin. He's a certified kettlebell functional movement specialist and professional performing strongman. As a kettlebell instructor, he teaches at the RKC certifications and conducts kettlebell workshops around the world and trains clients currently in the Nashville area. He's worked with college and professional teams and athletes and all branches of the U.S. Armed Forces. As a performing strongman, he keeps alive the old-time tradition that dates back to vaudeville and before, and he gets on stage and performs feats of strength such as tearing phone books, full decks of cards, bending steel spikes, and rolling frying pans. He does all that in his spare time. So, Dave, once again, thanks for being on the call tonight.
Thanks for having me, Ryan. I am super excited to be on the call and looking forward to seeing what kind of questions people have.
Good stuff. Let's just start this off. How did you get started in lifting? And how did the whole performing strongman thing and kettlebells kind of come to be to where you're at now?
Well, I've kind of been on again, off again most of my life with lifting stuff. I started watching The Incredible Hulk when I was a kid and wanted to be Lou Ferrigno. And then by the time I was grown, I realized that I really didn't have the genetic makeup to do that sort of thing. But still enjoyed going to the gym and picking up heavy stuff and all that sort of stuff. And then in about 2002, I got exposed to kettlebells by way of Muscle Media magazine. Pavel had written an article about doing one-arm push-ups and one-legged squats with the Marines. And there was these photos in there of Pavel and these Marines holding these funny-looking black balls with handles on them. And they were all in kind of the bottom position of the of a one-legged squat, and then I, you know, kept reading and found out that this guy, Pavel, was a former Russian Special Forces drill instructor and that these things were called kettlebells, and kind of filed that away in my head because I'd always been kind of a fan of the old-time strongman stuff, like Arthur Saxon, Eugene Sandow, and all that. So it looked kind of familiar to me, but I just kind of filed it away. And then about a week later, but it may be a little more, a little less than that. An acquaintance of mine had bought a kettlebell and asked me if I knew anything about it. And I said, well, yeah, I just read this article about it in Muscle Media. So he loaned me the kettlebell, and he loaned me the original Russian Kettlebell Challenge video on VHS is how far back we're going.
Oh, wow.
Which seems like a really long time ago right now. But
it does.
Yeah. But so it wasn't on, like, you know, laser disc or anything like that, because I'm a little older than you. But so I took it home, played with it, and the kettlebell weighed 16 kilos, roughly 35 pounds. And I set about watching the video and trying to figure out what to do with this thing. And I have this very vivid recollection of snatching that kettlebell 10 times with each arm and then kind of falling into a crumpled heap of exhaustion in my front yard and waiting for the buzzers to come and peck my eyes out and stuff. And I knew that there was something to it because I was pretty strong. I had a pretty strong deadlift, you know, in the high fours, low fives, pretty strong squat. You know, not world record stuff, but fairly strong for my size, which was just over 300 pounds at the time. And this 16-kilo kettlebell just completely whooped my ass. And I was faced with the choice of accepting the truth that there was something to it and I needed to pursue it, or continuing on in willful ignorance and playing in the gym like I had previously been playing and thinking that was going to do something for me. So I decided to pursue it. And it wasn't much longer after that. A few months later, I was in St. Paul, Minnesota at the RKC for the first time there with Pavel and with hundreds of kettlebells and a bunch of other people who were learning how to use them. And it was very much a paradigm shift for me. It was very much just one of those defining moments of my adult life, because everything about my life changed from that point forward, because now here I am on the phone with you, and I do this full time for a living. I travel around and teach people how to use kettlebells. I teach people locally here where I am, and that's kind of the short version of the kettlebell thing. And as far as the old time strongman stuff goes, I used to do like a CD of the month audio interview thing, kind of like what you're doing right now, but I would put it on CD and mail it out to people. And one of the people that I wound up doing an interview with is a guy named Dennis Rogers, who is the Association of Old-Time Barbell and Strongmen named him pound for pound the strongest man in the world for the feats he performs. And he's, just to see him, he's a very unassuming looking guy. He's about 5'8", about 170 pounds. He's in his early to mid-50s. And he just looks like some guy that lives down the street that would ride a Harley. But he bends wrenches. He holds back airplanes. I've seen him bend a quarter.
Oh, wow.
So it's just some pretty intense stuff that he's doing. And I befriended him and expressed an interest in learning how to do these things. And so he taught me a bunch of stuff.
That's cool.
I've worked on it for a little bit since then, and I'm actually able to go around and do that sort of stuff and get in front of people and use that as a vehicle to talk to people about how to focus their mind and what they really want to accomplish. Because that's really what it comes back to, is, you know, just focusing on what you want and then doing it.
Good life lesson for sure.
Yeah.
All right, well, now that we got a little bit of background out of the way, let's jump right into these questions. We've got a bunch of them. We'll try to bang out all of them if we can. And I apologize in advance to anybody listening if I butcher your name, but I'm going to do the best that I can. So first one comes in from Christopher Cardinale, and he asks, how does one incorporate grip training with other kettlebell routines while still staying fresh?
Okay. Keeping the grip fresh while training with kettlebells. And talking about grip training in general, it's a little bit of an it depends sort of question. When you say grip training, what are you talking about exactly? Because it's kind of like saying lifting weights, you know. Bodybuilders lift weights, power lifters lift weights, Olympic lifters lift weights, football players lift weights, but the weights are a means to an end. So if you're doing grip training, you know, if you're working on, say you've set a goal to close the number 3 Captain's a Crush gripper. Well, that's a very different goal than, say, bending a horseshoe. They both still involve grip strength, but it's a different application of that strength. So it kind of depends on what your grip training entails. Now, having prefaced everything with that little caveat, I'm a firm believer that with grip training especially, or anything that involves training the hands, the wrists, the forearms, anything like that, that it's better to do a little bit every day than it is to do a lot once or twice a week. And I believe that partly because it makes sense neurologically and partly because of my own experience. I have done it before where I've done grip-type things and pushed it to failure and tried to get all high intensity with it and everything and not been able to do anything for several days afterwards because my hands were so sore and my forearms were so sore and everything was all beat up. And I didn't make nearly as much progress doing that as I did treating it as a practice. I believe that strength is simply practice, to kind of rip off and paraphrase Houdini a little bit. Houdini said magic is practice. I think strength is the same thing, particularly with grip type stuff, because you're practicing a specific skill, and if that skill is bending horseshoes, then the best way to get better at that is to do things that relate to bending horseshoes. So working kettlebells into doing that, kettlebell training carries a grip element very naturally just because of the design of the kettlebell and because of the way the exercises work. The ballistic loading of things like swings and snatches puts a little more stress on the grip than some other modalities and some other types of training might. So there's a natural element of grip training that goes along with kettlebells. And if you don't have a specific thing in mind that you're training for with your grip, then just training with kettlebells the proper way will enhance your grip and kind of take care of that. If you have something specific, boards, like sometimes I'll get emails and stuff from martial artists, grapplers, that sort of stuff. They want to use kettlebells for their conditioning, but they want to work on their grip at the same time. I'll have them do stuff that mimics their sport. So maybe do wrap a towel around the handle of the kettlebell and do swings or kind of hammer throw type swinging around the head type stuff like that, or farmer's carries with a towel, because that kind of mimics the feeling of having your opponent's gi in your hand, and it builds that specific kind of endurance in the grip that you need to be an effective grappler like that. The main thing is learning to develop the ability to listen to your body and to be able to know when to back off intuitively, because a lot of times where we mess up, I think, is we go in and we start to train and we feel really strong, and so we push farther than we need to. Most of the time when I train, I finish my session feeling not really exhausted or beat up, feeling just as good, if not a little bit better than I did when I started. Occasionally, once every couple of weeks, I push myself from a conditioning standpoint to get a little more fatigue than that. But most of what I do is in terms of training skill and in terms of training the neurological adaptations rather than trying to get huge. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. Most people, they do have the mistake of, you know, adding that. I know I'm guilty of it. You're taking a set of deadlifts or taking, you know, the most random things to the point where your body just crumbles. Mm-hmm. And then for the next 3 or 4 days after that, you don't want to get out of bed. I know,
yeah.
Sure, everybody's guilty of that one. So definitely the moderation thing is, you know, key. And especially if you're dealing with your hands, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Feel for you to
and,
those.
And from a neurological standpoint, if you look at the way your nerves are distributed throughout your body, you have more sensory nerves in your hand, just in the palm of your hand, than you do in the entire rest of your arm. So I found out the hard way, but it stands to reason, if you just stop and think about it, that if you do stuff that causes a lot of stress and a lot of fatigue to the hands, you will fatigue your entire central nervous system by default, because there's so much neurological activity going on from a sensory perspective in your hands.
Definitely.
You can, if you just train heavy grip a lot to the point of exhaustion every day, you'll eventually, it won't take very long either, start feeling tired all the time, just like if you were doing, you know, a lot of squats or something like that that you would think would take more out of you. You won't be sore with the kind of onset muscular soreness that you have, but just neurologically you'll feel kind of beat down. And I've done that, and I don't want to do it again. So it's important to know how to rein yourself back in.
Definitely.
Especially when it's feeling good to you. That's a really dangerous time when you're feeling especially strong. You want to push a little harder. It's better to back off then. It's better to push right up to where you can see the edge but not look over it.
Gotcha.
And certainly not step off of it.
Well, the next question we got here comes from David Tharp, and he's been training with kettlebells seriously for the past several months and made significant strength gains and has become noticeably leaner. However, he's not gaining the muscle mass he would like. What would you recommend to add more lean muscle?
Eat more. that's when people are trying to get bigger, that's one of the two things that I go back to. If you're trying to get bigger lifting kettlebells, then you probably need to eat more or do more volume with a heavier weight. He didn't mention what size kettlebells he's using, so we'll assume that he's already doing something fairly heavy. You cannot discount the amount of metabolic activity that gets stimulated from doing kettlebell movements, because if you're doing it properly, if you're doing it the way that we do it in the RKC, you're just about everything you do is going to involve either a full body explosive movement or a full body tension movement. And anytime you're doing a full body type movement, you're going to be using more energy than if you were doing a set of curls or a set of, you know, tricep kickbacks with a pink dumbbell or something like that. So you have to take that into account. You will need to eat more regardless of how heavy the bell is if you're doing a lot of volume, especially if you want to gain size. So I would say up your food intake.
Would you recommend also maybe adding, I mean, it doesn't necessarily say in the question, but adding in like a barbell deadlift or something of that nature as well?
Yeah, I mean, like if you have access to that stuff, yeah, the barbell deadlift is, in my opinion, the king of mass building exercises, even more so than the squat. If for no other reason, it's easier to teach people.
I totally agree with that one. I'm more built for a deadlifting platform than a squat any day.
Yeah, a squat's a little bit difficult to teach people how to do compared to a deadlift. A deadlift is a very natural movement. I took my 4-year-old cousin bowling a couple of weeks ago, and he wanted to pick the ball up by himself, and he walked over to the ball, and he's 3 feet tall and weighs 60 pounds or whatever, and he walked over to the bowling ball and squatted down in a deep squat and wrapped his arms around it and picked it up, just like watching one of the guys at World's Strongest Man do a stone lift. I mean, it was a deadlift. He did a deadlift is what it amounted to. So it's a very natural movement that you don't really have to teach people. You just have to help them remember what it is. Squatting with a barbell has a little more technique involved, and it's a great exercise. I'm not knocking squats at all, but as far as ease of learning and slapping on a lot of meat, I would go with barbell deadlifts. If we're looking outside the context of lifting kettlebells, then, yeah, you can supplement with barbell deadlifts. I'm a fan of pull-ups. I'm a fan of dips and military press. Like those four movements are like the big ones for me for slapping on size. A lot of people like the bench press, and I'm not down on the bench press. I just am not a fan of it personally. I've never liked it personally. I don't see a lot of athletic carryover. But I know the bench press is the big one that people – if people find out that I'm a strong man, the first thing out of their mouth is, how much do you bench? And the next thing out of my mouth is, I have no idea. I haven't bench pressed in 7 years.
So, especially like a dip with 90 pounds attached to a belt, and then they look at you with a – funny look on your face.
Yeah.
Awesome. Moving on to the next one here. This is from David K. And what is the best way to increase the number of cards that one can tear? He's stuck at around 20 cards, and he can currently close the Captain of Crush 2.5 gripper for 3 reps with his right arm. So crushing grip shouldn't be a problem. And what specific techniques do you recommend for card-tearing newbies to employ?
Okay, that's a really, really good question. I'm glad people are asking stuff like that. First of all, I would look at the technique and make sure that you're not losing power anywhere in your technique. The next thing I would do, if he's tearing 20 cards pretty consistently, about once a week I would actually tear cards. And if you can tear 20, you can probably tear 22. And if you tear 22 cards, then maybe next week you can tear 25 or 28, you know, and just gradually add a couple of cards to the point that it's almost imperceptible. You know, if you go from 20 to 35, you're going to notice that. But if you go from 20 to 22, 23, 25, something like that, then you won't hardly notice it. So just gradually add cards like that. The problem you run into is that can get to be expensive. So
a lot of card decks.
Yeah, you go through a lot of cards that way. So the closing the Captain's of Crush grippers, this goes back to the kind of stuff I was talking about earlier, doesn't really have a whole lot of carryover to card tearing. What does have a lot of carryover to card tearing is plate curls and pinch grip stuff. So I would start doing some plate curls and some plate wrist curls. And what I mean by that is start pretty light. Start with maybe a 10-pound or a pair of 10-pound plates, and you would pinch grip them together, just like if you were going to pinch grip off the ground. And you would get them in a position like you were just going to do a curl, like just a regular dumbbell curl without the wrist pronation and supination, and just do curls that way. And keep your fingers as straight as you can, and keep your wrist as straight as you can when you do it. And keep the reps low. And in the beginning, do low sets, do like maybe 3 or 4 sets of 3 to 5 reps, and then gradually add sets, but keep the reps low. So work up to maybe 10 or 12 sets of 3, 4, 5 reps, something like that. And that would be on the top end of what you're going to do. And then when you can do that, go to a heavier weight, drop back down, and do a few sets of 3 and build up again. Ryan Pitts at StrongerGrip.com makes a great product called the Pinch Lever or Pinch Block Lever. I forget exactly what it's called, but essentially it's like a pinch block with a bar on it, and you can put plates on it. And you can keep the same amount of weight on it, but move it further away from the block on this, like, 14-inch long bar. So the leverage changes, and the weight effectively gets heavier, even though you don't have to add weight to it because the leverage point changes. I like those a lot for card tearing. And then the other thing for tearing cards, you can do the same thing like plate curls, but just do wrist curls. So you sit down and you would rest your forearm on your thigh with your wrist kind of hanging off your knee and do wrist curls with a pinch grip on plates the same way. And you can do that with one hand or two hands. And then the other thing for tearing cards is, since you will go through a lot of cards learning how to tear cards, I am a big fan of isometrics for doing any of this kind of old-time strongman stuff. So get a deck of cards and wrap it in 10 or 12 layers of duct tape. Wrap it up so that there's absolutely no hope of you tearing it at all. And then just practice isometrics for anywhere from 6 to 12 seconds. All-out effort, full-body effort, laying into it as hard as you can. And do anywhere from 3 to 10 sets like that once or twice a week. And then actually tear, like we were talking about, adding cards in maybe once a week. And you'll condition your hands. You will build that same nervous system kind of output strength. And, you know, throw your plate curls in there a couple days a week after you've done that. And it won't be long till you're blasting right through a deck of cards.
Sweet. I want to start practicing on that one. Press the frame.
Yeah, I mean, it's really simple. It's just a matter of putting the time in. The hardest part for me tearing cards when I was learning how to do it is the technique that I used wound up tearing skin off of my thumb. Ooh. And I did that thing where I tore a deck and it got real good to me, so I tore 5 or 6 decks right after that and just kind of shredded myself and made myself bleed and stuff. And I'm calloused there now, and it doesn't happen. I can tear 4 or 5 decks without anything bad happening to me. But it was, again, one of those cases of I felt real strong, so I pushed it too hard too soon. Or too far too soon. And, you know, there's no need to do that. Calm down, take a breath, and realize that you can either hurt yourself doing it all today, or you can get there in 1.5 or 2 weeks without causing any real damage.
Makes a lot of sense there. Next one we got, this is from Kiyoshi. And he is currently working on the Rite of Passage program, performing clean and press ladders and timed swings. Should he incorporate anything else for ladders or just designate all other lifts to his variety days?
The only other thing that I would add to the clean and press ladders is if you're interested in adding pull-ups in, then do pull-ups. And the way that would work with the ladder, for anybody who's not familiar with the Enter the Kettlebell Rite of Passage program, it's a program built around primarily kettlebell clean and press and kettlebell swing. And the rite of passage ultimately should end up with you doing a strict clean and military press with a kettlebell that is close to half your body weight. So if you weigh, you know, 175, it would be in a 40-kilo bell. If you weigh 220, it would be a 48-kilo bell, something like that. And then the other side of that is the Secret Service snatch test, which is 200 reps in 10 minutes with a 24-kilo kettlebell, switching hands whenever you want to. The rite of passage is designed to get you to that particular goal if you're patient and if you work it long enough. And the rite of passage is something that I come back to usually about every 3 or 4 months. I'll do anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks of rite of passage just because it's simple for me to follow, it works, and you know, if it's not broken, then why bother trying to fix something? Now, if he's doing the rite of passage, the way it's laid out in the book. Again, if anybody's not familiar with it, by ladders, what we mean is I would grab the kettlebell that I'm working with, and I would do one clean and press with one arm. I would switch hands and do one clean and press on the other side, put the kettlebell down and take a short rest. The next set would be two reps per side with this rest. And then the next set would be three reps per side, and so forth. And rite of passage is laid out so that you have very specific instructions on how many rungs of each ladder to climb. So the way that I tend to do that if I'm doing it by myself is if I'm not training with someone, if I'm alone, I will just pretend that I have a partner, and I'll do my one rep per side and set the bell down, and then imagine that my imaginary virtual training partner does one per side. And then I'll do two, and I'll rest as long as it took me to do two, imagining that someone else is doing it. So with each successive set, the set gets longer, but the rest period gets longer. So you build up volume over time that way. You can get a lot of reps in without going to failure or to any kind of exhaustion that way. So to add pull-ups into that, if you're interested in doing that, I would do one clean and press per side, then immediately do a pull-up, and then do two clean and press per side, and then immediately do two pull-ups, and work as far up the ladder as you can do that. That will help out your upper body strength tremendously, because it's the other component of the upper body movement. The clean and press is a push. The pull-up is obviously a pull. So you're working in both directions that way. Anything else, I would stick in on a variety day. And the way the rite of passage program is laid out, there are 3 days of clean and press and swings, and then a couple of days that are designated as variety days where you just kind of take it easy and practice new skill or do whatever you want, or nothing at all. You know, if you're kind of beat up and tired, you can just take the day off. But so if you're working on Turkish get-ups or bending horseshoes or, you know, anything like that, squeeze those in on your variety days, but don't push it too hard. The bulk of what you should be doing on the rite of passage is the clean and press and the swings.
Good stuff. I remember actually the ladders, Dan John, I don't know if anybody's familiar with him, but he's a very big proponent of doing kettlebell ladders and clean and press ladders and pull-ups.
Oh, absolutely. And I actually ripped off some of his ideas and have come up with some pretty pretty devastating things that that I'm working on.
He's a good guy.
Yes, and he's a genius.
Next question comes from Nick, and this is kind of a general question. He says, how many times a week should one train to allow for hypertrophy and strength increases at the same time?
Stop me if this sounds familiar, but it depends. Without looking at the specific program, it's hard to make a call on that one. Well, let's assume that you're doing something like a moderate weight, high volume type thing. I would go 3 or 4 days a week like that. If you're doing something that's a lot heavier than that, you may need a little more recovery. If you're doing something like a 20 rep squat routine, you may need several days recovery in between. I appreciate the question, and I wish I had a better answer, but without knowing specifically what kind of program's going on, it's really hard to make that call. And that's kind of the art of what we do rather than the science. Is the science is knowing the anatomy and the physiology and the nutrition and the biomechanics and all that. The art of it is knowing how to take that science and apply it to a living, breathing human being and take into account their psychology and take into account all the day-to-day stresses that they have with their job or their kids or their wife or their family or their dog or their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, and be able to blend those two things together. That's the art of it. And I'm going to have to say there's not really enough information there for me, but kind of a, you know, to make a specific call on that, but kind of a general rule is we'll come back to anywhere from 2 to 4 times a week. We'll get you bigger and stronger at the same time. If you're lifting heavy, if you're lifting appropriately, and if you're getting enough rest and enough food in your belly.
Good stuff. And to add to that, one of the I know at the gym I train out of, strength camp with Elliot Holes, one of the best ways we build size and strength is just heavy, high rep sets of deadlifts. I mean, to the point where it gets uncomfortable, you know.
Yeah.
And most people tend to steer away from things like that, but at the same time, nothing beats training like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the solution to getting big and strong is lift heavy stuff, eat a lot, and get enough rest. Everything else is details.
All right, next question here comes from George Morgan. He asks, what is one exercise that you think helps the most in shoulder strength and back strength?
Shoulder strength and back strength, one exercise. I'm going to go with the Turkish get-up. That's one of the Turkish get-up has a magic in it that that very few other exercises have, and the reason being is for the shoulder particularly is you're taking it through this really unique range of motion type thing, working on supporting strength as you're moving through all these different angles of the shoulder. So it'll really strengthen. I like to call it deep strength. It feels like it's like deep in the socket with all the connective tissue and stuff that's in there. Really good for the smaller muscles that keep the shoulder healthy, as well as for, you know, the deltoids and traps and all of that that make you look big and impressive. So definitely that. A big fan of military presses too, particularly with the kettlebell. And the reason I like the kettlebell military press more than the barbell or dumbbell military press is because you can get a greater range of motion. I can take kettlebell, rack it out to the side the way we rack a kettlebell, and my hand is well below my chin when I start, and I can press all the way up to complete extension so that my bicep is almost grazing my ear, and my palm faces forward, and still have room to do that with a weight in each hand. You know, if you get heavy dumbbells, it's hard to turn the palms so that they face forward without and maintain vertical with the arms because the bells will run into each other. With kettlebells, it's not as much of an issue. So military press for shoulders, Turkish get-ups for overall everything with the shoulder emphasis.
Awesome. This next next question is from Connor Garrity. He asks, what is the most effective way to gain powerful, explosive muscle without subjecting the back to stress, like such as squats and deadlifts? He has injured his back and doesn't want to re-injure it.
First of all, find somebody who knows what they're doing and get them to teach you the right way to deadlift. Because if you hurt your back when you're deadlifting, you're doing it wrong. That's what we call an indicator. Having said that, I find that you can use the kettlebell swing to teach the same movement pattern as the deadlift and actually get a lot of explosive strength that has carryover to deadlifts from doing kettlebell swings and kettlebell cleans, because you're able to do a lot more volume with a much lighter weight and train, again, that neurological strength by doing that. I, several years ago, focused on doing long cycle clean and jerk with kettlebells, and I was only using 24 kilos, a pair of 24 kilos. And long cycle clean and jerk, for people who don't know, is it's you do one clean, you swing the kettlebells back between your legs, snap the hips, bring them into the rack position, and then from there you jerk them overhead. The kettlebell jerk is kind of like a barbell jerk, but without the split or without the really deep squat. We just jerk it and do a knee dip that's just enough to get the arms locked out and stand up with it. I did pretty much nothing else but clean and jerk for about 4 or 5 months. And then within 2 weeks after doing that, I had added 25 pounds to my best ever deadlift without having practiced the deadlift. So I, you know, added 25 pounds to it. And that's not an unusual thing. I worked with the Vanderbilt football team, and I got a call from their head strength coach. They had been doing swings and snatches and I think just Turkish get-ups, just those three exercises with kettlebells. and they had a kid that added 125 pounds to his barbell clean, and they practiced cleans twice during the 4 months. And
wow.
the only thing I can attribute to that is he had trained his nervous system to send the message to his muscles to be more explosive because he was doing so much explosive kettlebell lifting. People get caught up in the big and strong thing, and to quote my colleague Brett Jones, big ain't strong, strong is strong. And I'm a big fan of being big and strong, but it's that, it's big and strong, not big equals strong. So there are a lot of strong, small guys out there, and they're strong because their nervous system knows how to tell their muscles to contract with enough force and enough tension to express that strength. Muscles are dumb. They're really, really, really stupid. All they do is whatever the nervous system tells them to do. So if we can stop thinking, at least partially, about getting big equaling being strong, and go back and start thinking about actually getting strong, then we get stronger.
Hmm.
And once you get strong, it's easier to get bigger because you're able to move more weight. At that point, it's a matter of recovery and food and manipulating volume.
In doing nothing but the kettlebell cleaning jerks for that long, did you see what kind of physique changes did you see? I mean, did you lean out a lot or was?
Yeah, I was hungry all the time. I was doing a lot of volume too, but I was hungry all the time. I think I lost 7 or 8 pounds and wasn't really trying to lose any weight. And I had not like super noticeable, but it was apparent to people who hadn't seen me for a month or two in between there that the size and shape of my traps and my deltoids had improved from, I guess, from all the jerks.
That's cool.
So, yeah.
All right. Let's see. Moving on to the next question, we got this from Sean Arnold. If there was one grip exercise that you think is the best, which one would it be?
One what exercise? One grip exercise?
Yeah, one grip exercise for building the most grip strength.
One grip exercise. That's a tough one because, like we talked about earlier, it's kind of a specific thing. I'm a big fan of plate curls. Plate curls are really good. I think they have a lot of carryover to a lot of different activities involving the grip. So you have to tell me first what it is that you wanted. If you just want to have a stronger grip, you can get a lot of grip strength out of doing ballistic exercises with kettlebells. If you want better grip endurance, then farmer's carries are really good. Deadlifts are really good. Crushing strength, I think is kind of a specific thing. It works best with grippers if you're going to do that. But I guess all the way around, I would say either plate curls or some variation of plate curls and maybe levering type stuff with sledgehammers.
Cool. Next question comes from Dwayne. He doesn't have anybody to train with and can't seem to get out of the starting and stopping cycle. Any tips for long-term training motivation?
Doesn't have a partner and is consistently starting a new program and then
stopping, I would assume.
Then stopping and then starting and then stopping. And yeah. I would say that, I'd say, Dwayne, you need to figure out why this is important to you. Because to go back to Dan John, you have your behavior and you have your goal. And does your behavior match your goal? So if your goal is to, you know, put on 20 pounds or to deadlift 500 pounds or to lose 20 pounds, does your behavior match up to whatever you say your goal is? Because, you know, if you want to put on 20 pounds and you're missing workouts and you're eating junk food and you're not getting any sleep, then your behavior doesn't match your goal. If you want to deadlift 500 pounds and all you're doing is, you know, concentration curls with a 20-pound dumbbell and calf raises, your behavior doesn't match your goal. So that's maybe sit down with a piece of paper and write out, this is my goal and whatever the relevant information is that surrounds that goal, and then write down, this is why this goal is important to me. And then after that, write down, this is what I am willing to give up in order to achieve that goal.
That's kind of
how I approach motivation. What do I want, and what am I willing to give up to get it?
That carries over many more aspects other than training as well.
Yeah. I mean, because the training part is really the easy thing. It's just execution of a plan. The hard part is the planning and the motivation and the scheduling and all of that. Without the motivation, you're just going through the motions. I mean, if you want to lose 20 pounds, you have to be willing to give up beer and cheese fries, at least for a short period of time. If you want to deadlift 500 pounds, you have to be willing to go in and do a lot of deadlifts. So figure out why it's important to you, and then figure out what you're willing to give up.
Good stuff. Next question we got is from Steven. He asks, how do you legitimately rip a phone book, and what do you recommend the best way is to train for this feat?
Legitimately ripping a phone book is a topic near and dear to my heart. There are several different ways to rip a phone book, and there are ways to use trickery to make yourself look strong and rip a phone book when you're really not. There are a lot of people on YouTube going, well, I can rip a phone book. It's just a trick. And there is a trick to doing it. There is a trick to doing it the way that they do it. It's not a legitimate feat of strength. It's more like it's a trick. The legitimate feat of strength way to do it is what we call the grip and rip technique. And I learned it from Dennis Rogers. And just a quick rundown of the technique, if I can describe it, hopefully people can picture what I'm saying and without having, you know, actual video or seeing me do it. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to tear the book parallel to the binding, not across the binding. So if the person tearing the phone book is right-handed, we're going to take the binding side of the book and we're going to put that in our left hand, with the binding kind of outside the pinky and running in that direction. So you're holding on to the top of the book with the binding, the spine of the book, out to your left. And you do that same kind of a pinch-type movement we were talking about earlier with the plate curls. You take the other end of the binding and you brace it against your hip, and then you take that left hand and you put it kind of against your thigh so that you're able to press your hand into your thigh and you're able to press the book into your hip. Now what you've done is you've locked the book into place between your hand, your thigh, and your hip. So the book can't move all over the place. It's kind of like putting it in a vise. You take the right hand and you grab the book at the top, same side, where the left hand is holding on to it. So just your hands are kind of next to each other, just like you were going to rip a sheet of paper in half. And you pull up and out with the right hand. And you have to squeeze really hard. That's where the plate curls really come in handy with it, is if you're not squeezing hard enough, then you're not going to get a legitimate tear on it. And when it's a legitimate tear, you can pull on it and it will all kind of tear at the same time and you'll just have a straight line torn through the book. If it's not a legitimate tear, if it's kind of the popping method that I'm not even going to talk about, then the tear will be kind of jagged and funky looking. So you brace it against your leg, you squeeze real hard and you pull. If your pinch grip is not strong enough, then what will happen is the cover and two or three of the pages from either end will rip off into your right hand, and your right hand will come flying off, and you'll have part of the cover in your hand from the top and the bottom, and the rest of the book will be intact. That means that you're not squeezing hard enough. So go back to your plate curls at that point. And that's really all there is to the legitimate phone book tearing technique, the grip and rip that I learned from Dennis Rogers. The progression on doing that is a lot like what I described with the cards earlier, if you can't tear the full phone book that's in whatever city you live in, split it down the spine to whatever thickness you can tear and start practicing with that. And then next week, add 15 or 20 pages. And next week, add 15 or 20 pages. And then eventually you get to where you're tearing 1,200, 1,500, 2,000 pages. The other thing you can do is very similar to what I said with the cards earlier, is take the phone book that's whatever the size is that you're working on and wrap it in 20 layers of duct tape so that there's no hope of you ripping it, but it still has a little bit of flex in it. And get in that same position with that same technique and do isometric pulls for 6 to 12 seconds, sets 5 to 10 of those once or twice a week, and really, really work on that initial pull. Once you get the tear started, it's pretty easy to complete. But that initial tear is the most difficult thing. So work on the isometrics with that and work on gradually doing something progressive. It goes back to the same principle of progressive overload that we've heard about for years and years and years with Milo and the Bull, right? He picked up the calf and he carried it around the arena every day, and by the time the Olympics rolled around, he was carrying a full-grown bull. You take 200, 250 pages and you get to where you can tear that and you practice that technique, and then you gradually add more and more pages. So it's a progressive training type thing. You put that in with your plate curls and you should be good to go.
Cool. Once again, it just comes back to keep practicing it over and over again.
Yeah. Well, strength is practice. I was fortunate enough when I decided to get serious about phone books that I had a guy that I hadn't spoken with in a while contacted me on Facebook. I had put on my Facebook that I was looking for phone books that needed killing, and he sent me a message, said, "We've got some laying around the office if you want to come by and pick them up." And if you've ever gotten phone books in bulk before, they come, or at least in Nashville where I am, they come 8 in a pack wrapped in plastic. And so he told me that they had some bundles of them laying around, and I'm thinking I'm going to go to his office and pick up, 16, maybe 24 phone books if I'm lucky. I show up, and they've got literally a small office-size room full of these bundles, and I made out of there with, I think, 212 phone books. And
oh, wow.
I couldn't tear a phone book at the time. But by the time I got those books home and figured out how many I could tear, I split them down the spine like that and figured how many pages I could tear, and worked my way up gradually like that. Another thing about tearing phone books is, anybody who's seen any of the YouTube clips that I have of me training at home, I have a shed out in my backyard. It's a 10x12 shed that I keep all my stuff in. I call it the Shed of Strength, which kind of started out as a joke, but I kind of like it because it's the Shed of Strength. And I put about half of those phone books in that shed, and I brought about half of them in my house. And so I'm out there, and it's in summertime, and I'm in Tennessee, and it's 95% humidity, and it's 100 degrees, and I'm sweating all over these books, and I'm yanking and pulling and trying to tear them. And I would spend 15 or 20 minutes tearing half a phone book in half, and it just was miserable, And I did that for a few weeks, and then I came in one day, or I was inside the house one day, and I grabbed one of the ones that had been inside the house the whole time and gave it a shot, and it just flew apart. I just ripped it right in half. So I called up Dennis Rogers and was talking to him about it, and he said, yeah, if you leave them out in the humidity, the phone book will soak up that humidity, and it makes it a lot harder to tear. It makes it almost kind of a spongy type feeling. So if you're going to work on tearing phone books, and the same thing applies to cards, keep them in a dry place, unless you just want them to be really, really difficult to tear. Because the way I look at it, there are training books or training cards, and then there are performing cards. And it could be the same brand of card, because some brands of cards are more difficult than others, or it could be the same size phone book. But if I leave my, I've got a big stack of phone books here at the house now, and I leave some of them out in the shed, because I know they're going to be harder, even though they're the same size, which allows me to practice the same technique, but have more resistance when I do it. But if I'm going to a show, then I'm going to take something that I know is going to just fly apart, because it's more impressive that way. And it doesn't really matter for the people, because the people aren't going to be able to tear it either way.
Yeah, so either way, you're going to impress them.
Yeah. And that's what people want to see. They want to see they want to see the feet done, and they want to see it look like it's not that big a deal, even though it is. So.
Definitely.
Next question.
All right. Next question we got is from Dave. He also, what's the best kettlebell exercise for hamstring work?
Swings.
Swings? Awesome. Mm-hmm. We move right on to the next one. Bernice asks, she's a 7-year-old woman, 5'10", 192 pounds. What kettlebell exercises do you suggest for her to gain muscle and lose fat without damaging her already arthritic joints? She's worked in construction most of her life, so she's fairly strong for her age, but she doesn't want to keep losing ground as she gets older.
And she's how old?
70.
70? Wow.
70.
First of all, a big round of applause to a 70-year-old woman who's wanting to know how to get stronger. That's awesome.
So that's no easy feat either.
Yeah, I mean that's awesome because I know a lot of men and women both that are 45 and think they're old and done. So so first off, hats off to her for that. If she's arthritic, first of all, doctor's clearance. That's just kind of the caveat because I don't want some lady going and doing something and then hurting herself and then suing me because I said do it. So get your doctor's clearance first if you have any sort of medical condition like that. I would find a competent instructor. If you go to the Dragon Door website and look at the list of RKC instructors, there's one near you somewhere. If you can't find one, email me at irontamerdave@hotmail.com and I will try to help you find someone. But it's critical for someone who has any sort of a joint or bone issue like that to practice perfect technique from the get-go, because if you don't, then it's going to wind up causing problems. I would also find someone who's skilled in the functional movement screen and make sure that there aren't any kind of imbalance or anything like that going on. Having said all that, I would give a steady diet of swings and Turkish get-ups at least for the first month to 3 months to work on that movement skill, to work on mobility in the hips and shoulders and the thoracic spine, and to work on linking everything together. Because what I've found, I've worked with people who are silver foxes like that, people who have been around a while, and they tend to have a lot of mileage. And she said she works construction, or she has worked construction, so she's probably got a unique set of physical dysfunction that comes from doing that sort of work. And I have found that it is better to spend a lot of time working with the movement patterns that are covered with the swing and get up and really get those movements dialed in before you try to do anything else. Because if your movement pattern is screwed up and you add strength and conditioning on top of that, then you're just speeding yourself on the highway to injury. So the short answer is swings and Turkish get-ups. The long answer is everything else that I just said.
And that's going to call you, and that's going to go back a lot to listening to, you know, her body and what she can and can't do during the day. And
absolutely.
Kind of training by feel would probably be really good advice in her case.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is people, and I'm this way too, we want it all and we want it yesterday. But the thing you have to keep in mind that whatever body you're walking around in right now is the one that you've earned through your habits, through your activities, through your exercise programs, through your lack of exercise, through whatever injuries you've had. You're walking around in whatever body you have earned just from the mileage you've accumulated. So you have to own that. And if you have dysfunction, you have to own that dysfunction and then go about correcting it. And you must understand that you didn't get screwed up overnight. You will not get unscrewed overnight in most cases. The good news is a lot of times you can take something that took 10 or 15 years to get at its absolute worst and correct it in a matter of a few months. So,
all right.
You know, change direction and head toward health.
Good stuff. All right. This is from Lewis. How does he block off the pain or work up towards handling the pain from bending something? His hands and grip just get out too soon.
That's a really good one. I like that. There is something that is innate in all of us that wants us to be safe and healthy. So to deliberately expose yourself to something that causes pain is a very unnatural thing to do. It is not a natural activity to bend a horseshoe. It's painful. And when I was first learning how to do it, the palms of my hands were sore, and I had these massive bruises on my leg from where the edge of the shoe is digging into my thigh. Learning to shut that off is a skill in and of itself that is easy to explain but really difficult to learn how to do, because you have to experience it to be able to do it. I was talking to Slim the Hammerman Farman, if people know who Slim is, then they know he's a legend. If they don't, then they have no idea what I'm talking about. Slim calls it the governor. This thing in your brain that is a self-preservation mechanism. You can develop the ability to consciously override that. The first step in doing that is to look at whatever activity you're doing, whatever feat that you're trying to perform, and knowing that you've taken every possible precaution as far as safety goes to keep from injuring yourself. And when you understand that logically and rationally, it's easier to talk the irrational part of your brain into believing that you're capable of doing something. Once you've done that, it takes practice to cultivate it, but if you can trick yourself into believing that it's a life and death situation, then suddenly you turn into that mythical woman who lifts the car off of her child, you know?
Yep.
And she was all, she's not strong enough to do that, and yet she did it. That's happened to me before when I've been in front of people. Being in front of people and doing a feat of strength is an amazingly motivating thing for me. It happened not too long ago. I was at a party with my wife, and new people I just met, like, what do you do? And I try to explain to them what it is I do, and they look at me like I'm crazy, because I think in some ways I am. And someone had seen my Facebook photo profile, and I'm rolling a frying pan in that. And they're like, what is that you're doing with a frying pan? I said, well, I roll it up. And the ladies whose house we're at is like, no way. And I'm like, yeah, it's part of what I do. So she goes in the kitchen and comes back with this frying pan and just hands it to me. And I'm like, well, I'll give it a shot and see what happens. And so I grabbed it, and I leaned into it, and it gave a little bit. And the way this particular pan was made is the bottom part that rests on the eye was a lot thicker than the rest of the pan, kind of the bowl part of the pan. So the bowl part gave, and it started to roll. And I heard a few gasps like people do when they've never seen that sort of thing. And then I hit that thicker part, and it just stalled. And so I stopped, and I said, yeah, I don't know about this. And I looked up, and all these people are looking at me like, well, that's impressive anyway. And I said, yeah, I'll hit it one more time. And so I hit it again, and it gave, and then it sprang back on me. And that's the feeling it give, but then feeling it come back against me, kind of flipped that switch in my head that I'm talking about. And I looked over at my wife, and she said, oh, shit, it's about you and the pan now. And I said, yeah. And she knew that either me or that pan was going down at that point. And so I just laid into it and managed to roll it up. But it was a situation where the pan that was handed to me is not one like I would normally use in a show. The ones that I use in shows are pretty consistent, and I know that I'm going to get it every time I pick the pan up. This one I had no idea, but it was handed to me, and so I gave it a shot. I did roll it up. It wasn't as tight a roll as I normally get, but I did manage to get it rolled up. And it was one of those situations, if I had been alone out in the shed, I never would have rolled that pan up. It would have been too hard for me to do. But since there were those people there, and they were expecting to see this happen, I was able to tap into whatever this governor thing is and finish the roll. And all of that to say, you have to practice what you do enough to know kind of where your limit is physically. I've rolled enough frying pans and done enough of this kind of stuff that I know the difference in how it feels for something that's about to get injured and something that just hurts a lot. And once you're able to understand that difference and kind of process that intellectually, you can start to shut off the hurt. The danger that you run into is that the further down that road you go, the more likely you are to shut off something that's going to injure you. So, you know, Slim has told me that he's broken bones in shows before in his wrist lifting hammers and not known it until after the show was over with. I've seen Dennis Rogers bend wrenches and poke holes in his palms, and after he's done, he notices that he's bleeding. So understand that skill comes at a price. And if you're willing to pay the price, then you'll be able to do the feats. If you're not, then I'm certainly not going to think less of anybody because they're not willing to see how much pain they can inflict upon themselves. It's not for everybody.
No, but I'm sure if anybody gets interested in it, I mean, there's got to be that switch to somewhere where they're like, a lot of people will give it a try. It's the ones that stick with it, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and that's sure. The thing. If you can imagine that someone was standing there and they either had a gun on you or they had a gun on your wife or, you know, your child or your mother or you know, someone who was really important to you like that, and it's either do this feat or I pull the trigger, if you can kind of muster that within yourself, then you'll be unstoppable. But it's a hard thing to learn how to do.
Yes, channeling that energy for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All
and
right.
It starts to get kind of esoteric sounding and everything, but I believe that it's all about knowing that you can do something. I talked to Zach Evanish about that a few weeks ago. You have to know, not just believe, but you have to know that you can do it. Because there's a difference between believing and knowing, in my opinion.
And that, once again, you know, relates to, you know, it's how, you know, relates more to life, as in, you know, the kind of the value of training that you get, you know, from actually doing the training to mentally pushing yourself in other aspects of your life as well, which is one of the
Absolutely.
Main things.
Absolutely. And you and I met at a conference for fitness professionals where the majority of the subject matter had to do with increasing your business and generating more revenue in your business. And the principles are pretty much the same. You know, if you believe that you can accomplish something, you'll get to a certain level. But if you know that you're going to accomplish it, you'll go way beyond what you believe you're capable of doing. And it's the same thing with doing physical things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to learn how to remove whatever limitations you put in front of yourself. Because pretty much any limitation in your life is something that's self-imposed. Now, I know that, you know, like if you're paralyzed in a wheelchair, then, you know, you're not going to get up and squat 500 pounds. You know, there's some stuff that is outside the realm of what I'm talking about. But if you're a normal functioning human being who has all of your faculties and all of your physical attributes, you'd be amazed at what you're capable of accomplishing.
That is true. And most people...
And if you look around and someone else has done it, then you know it's humanly possible.
Mm-hmm.
If someone else can bend a horseshoe, then you can. If someone else can make a certain amount of money in whatever business it is that you're interested in doing it, then you can do it. The limitations are whatever you put in your own way.
Definitely.
And that's right. A process and a skill that has to be practiced too, is getting out of your own way.
Yeah, that's a topic for a whole other call in itself.
Absolutely.
All right, let's.
What else we got?
You bang out some more questions. Big Percy, for your RKC test, did you do hardstyle or corkscrew?
Hardstyle.
All right. Pat Bittner asks, Dave, how do you know when to move to a bigger kettlebell with a different kettlebell exercise? It's kind of a I'd assume when it gets too light.
Yeah. I have the luxury of having every size kettlebell that, that Dragon Door makes in pairs. So that goes back to what specific driller you're talking about. When you completely own the technique, you can start adding some more weight to it. But then again, the flip side of that is sometimes you don't know if you own the technique unless you try to do something that's a little heavier. So who was that, Pat Bittner? Did I ask that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pat, if you've got a specific exercise or something like that in mind, shoot me an email, and I'll try to answer it a little more in depth.
All right. Next one, William Ellsworth. Champagne is a long name. He recently acquired a monster kettlebell, 96 kilogram, and wants to begin his way to snatch it. What exercises and what frequency best prepares him for that?
For snatching a 96-kilo kettlebell?
Yeah, that's a big guy.
That's a big kettlebell. 212-pound snatch with the kettlebell. Well, I'd need to know where he is in his snatching right now. If he's snatching 16 kilos, then he's got a long ride to go. But if he's snatching 48 kilos, he's halfway there. I would recommend for heavy snatching like that, using that same ladder approach that we talked about with the end of the kettlebell rite of passage earlier. Use a heavy kettlebell, one that you can snatch maybe 8 or 10 times, and ladder it up to 5. And do that 3 times a week or so. Do that for about 4 weeks, and then back off for a week, and then start a new cycle of doing maybe 2, 3, or 4 reps per side, starting at the top of the minute. I've had a lot of success in going up in weight for low reps with kettlebells, doing this particular kind of thing. You would set a timer for 1 minute, and then do 1 or 2 reps per side in snatching, and then put the bell down. With say if he's working towards, if he can snatch 40 pretty easily for, you know, 8 or 9 reps, and 48 for maybe 1 or 2, practice this with the 40. So do 1 or 2 reps, put it down, rest at the top of the next minute. Do 1 or 2 reps, put it down, rest at the top of the next minute. When you get to about 30 minutes of doing that, then you cut the time back to 20 minutes. And instead of doing 2 reps, do 3 reps per set and work your way back up to 30 minutes. When you've gotten to 30 sets of 3 and 3 that way, drop back to 20 reps, or to 20 minutes rather, and then do 4 and 4 and work up to 30 minutes that way. By the time you do that, you should be pretty comfortable with the next heavier bell. The problem you're going to run into with a 96-kilo bell is there's not a lot in between sizes on that. So you're going to run into a little snag that way. I would probably say do heavy clean and jerks with it as well to get used to supporting that much weight overhead. The heaviest kettlebell I've ever snatched was a 64 kilo. Yeah, 132 pounds or whatever it was. No, that's not right. It was 64 kilos, 130-something, 140-something pounds, whatever that is. And I had never snatched anything heavier than a 48-kilo before that, and I walked up to it and snatched it. And it wasn't a pretty snatch, but it was a snatch. So you can build a lot of strength with weight that's a lot lower than what your one rep max is just by practicing the technique on the lift.
Yeah, that kind of goes back. We do a lot of tire flipping at our gym, and a lot of people, like, we have a 400 and a 600 and a 750, and really the weight doesn't so much of a matter. It's just the funny thing is, the more you do it, the easier it gets, no matter how heavy the tire is, because you just get used to the motion. You get acquired to it.
Yeah, yeah. That's strength skill we were talking about earlier, you know. And, of course, absolutely, when somebody snatches a 96-kilo kettlebell, I want to see footage of that. If you put up footage of you snatching the 96-kilo kettlebell, go out and buy a 6-pack of whatever you want, send me the receipt, and I will I will reimburse you for that. I will buy you a six pack.
Good stuff. Next question is from Anderson. He asks, what is a surefire fat burning program for an overweight guy? He needs to lose 50 to 60 pounds and wants to get to 200 from 260 over using kettlebells as exercise modality. So I guess a surefire fat burning program.
Surefire fat burning program is eat less and move more. That's the simplified version of it. I would... I'm a big fan of the Warrior Diet. Some people, that doesn't make sense to them, and so they won't do well at it. Find a nutritional program that makes sense to you, that you can live with day in and day out and stick to for the long haul. And it should include a lot of protein and a lot of green things and not much else. If you're a frequent feeder, that's fine. If you're an intermittent faster, that's fine too. But I'm a big fan of meat and greens. And put that together. Keep a food log because you eat more than you think you do. But, Dave, I eat really healthy. No, you don't. No, you don't, because I think I do until I start writing it down. And when you write it down, you'll be less likely to eat the donut or the chocolate chip cookie or drink the beer or whatever your particular thing that you enjoy is. As far as a workout goes, I like swings a lot. They burn a lot of calories. I like to do things from a fat-burning perspective. I like to do things with kettlebells for time rather than specific number of reps. Big fan of the Gym Boss timer. I do this in my boot camps because most of my people that come to boot camp want to burn some body fat. What I'll do is I'll pick a few different exercises, maybe four or five, and I'll set the timer for either 45 seconds and 15 seconds or 50-10 or 40-20, something along those lines. And we will do the drill for 40 to 50 seconds, and then we'll use that 10 to 20 seconds to transition to the next drill. And then just do that, work up to between 16 and 25 minutes of doing that. So a good sequence of exercises. Say you've only got one kettlebell. We would do a press with one arm, a press with the other arm, a row with one arm, a row with the other arm, and then a squat holding the goblet squat holding the kettlebell in the by the horns in front of you, and repeat that sequence. So each individual exercise, including the rest period, transition period, takes 1 minute. So one time through that sequence would take 5 minutes. Repeat that sequence four or five times, rest a little bit, and then spend about 10 or 15 minutes doing swings. If you really want to get down to specifics about it, set the timer for, say, 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, and do 10 rounds of swings like that. So you've done 10 minutes worth of swings, you've done 20 or 25 minutes worth of the circuit type stuff, and the whole workout would take probably 35, 40, 45 minutes tops, including loosening up and recovery in between the circuit and the swings. If you do that kind of thing three or four times a week and cut out anything from your diet that wasn't food 100 years ago, because if it wasn't food 100 years ago, it's not food now. You eat the kind of food that God intended you to eat. It'll burn off pretty quick. You can mix in body weight exercises like that too. Say your clean and press technique's not real good. You could do row and push up, or you could do a split squat or a lunge on one leg and then on the other leg. We do that kind of stuff all the time in the National Kettlebell Boot Camp.
All right. Next,
if you set up a 3-day-a-week thing, you do that twice a week, and then once a week do Turkish get-ups for 20 minutes, and then the following week do the get-ups 2 days and that circuit 1 day, and just, you know, so that you've done it three times. Each workout, you've done it three times in a two-week period. Let me know how you look in 12 weeks.
Good stuff. Next one, actually, Clay Bueller asks, how do you know if you're overtraining? What's a good indicator?
You will get weaker. You will be tired all the time. You'll probably catch the flu. You'll be grumpy and irritable and have dark circles under your eyes. You won't be fun to be around, and you'll get weaker. You won't make progress. So going back to what we talked about early on in the call, when you feel really strong, that's when you're at the most dangerous place in terms of overtraining, because if you're just following a fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants instinctive type workout and you don't have the experience to be able to handle the freedom that comes with that, you will overtrain, because you'll feel really good and you'll keep going and you'll do that for 2 or 3 weeks, and the next thing you know, you'll just feel like crap. So I'm a big fan of planning things in advance until you are in touch with yourself enough that you don't have to. If you plan it in advance, then you can still back off. But if you plan to do something that, you know, is X number of sets and reps or volume or whatever, and you do more than that, then you've not followed your plan.
All right. Let's see. Next one. This comes from John Barrow. He asks, what's the most common kettlebell movement that most people have no business trying yet, or that you see the most mistakes being made?
The most mistakes being made. A lot of people screw up the bent press. The bent press, the right to do the bent press is something that I think you have to earn. You have to put in a lot of time with a bell overhead. You have to put in a lot of Turkish get-ups and windmills. You have to have proper thoracic spine mobility, or else you're not going to do it. The bent press, however, is a pet lift of mine that I'm kind of a snob about to a great degree. So I want everybody to learn how to do the bent press, but it's one of those things that it's pretty technical and it takes a lot of time to get there. The other one is the swing. A lot of people screw up a swing. They'll watch me they don't watch me. They watch like Jillian Michaels on YouTube and think they know how to do a swing because they watched her infomercial. And then the next thing you know, well, kettlebells made my back hurt. And to paraphrase Dan John, no, the way you swung the kettlebell made your back hurt. So.
All right.
I've seen a lot of people do a lot of stuff that they're calling get-ups that are pretty lethal too. So,
yeah, I've seen some. I mean, I know I'm probably guilty of messing up all of the above.
Well, there's a lot of ways to do a get-up, and I'm a fan of most of the variations of it. As long as it's safe, then you're not doing a get-up wrong, in my opinion. Now, we have some very specific things in the RKC that we do with the get-up that's designed technically to achieve a particular goal or a particular response in the body. That doesn't mean that something different than that is wrong. It's just it's using a screwdriver to drive a nail. You know, it's the wrong tool for the job or the right tool for the job. But then again, you see some people who do stuff like, I saw a video of somebody on YouTube doing a get-up, and they were keeping the arm locked overhead and trying to switch hands without taking the kettlebell from over their head, which I think is kind of a self-correcting thing, because once you drop it on your head and die, you won't do that anymore. But, you know, if you're switching a kettlebell overhead or over your face, then that's dumb and you shouldn't do it.
All right, here's a good question from Sebastian. He asks, where should one start for bending things? He started with a nail he could bend but could not bend the harder one after numerous tries in about a month.
Relate
to nail bending. So.
Yeah, well, if you've got a nail that you can bend and then whatever the next bigger thing is something that you can't bend, then spend a lot more time with the one that you can bend and work on your technique and practice the technique and develop the ability to generate force with that specific technique. Jed Johnson wrote a great resource for nail bending from Diesel Crew, and I think it's called something really clever like the Nail Bending Book or something like that. They sell that on the Diesel Crew site and on Jed Johnson's blog. It's an invaluable resource. There's a lot of approach short bending like that, and I'm not a great short bender, but I understand how it's done. The way I got better at bending was I found, I got the Iron Mind bag of nails and kind of worked through that and ran out of nails and thought, okay, well, I need to get some more nails. I went to the hardware store and found some 60-penny nails, and I bought a 50-pound box of them and worked through that. And I bought the next 50-pound box, and they were a lot harder. So I went and bought about 15 pounds of another from another store of the same size nails that were easier. Because what you run into is nails, by and large, are made out of recycled steel. And the way steel is graded is it has to meet a minimum hardness of whatever it is, however they measure the stuff. And as long as it's that minimum, then it can be whatever above that. So if I say to you, Ryan, you know, we're going to go out somewhere and I want you to bring at least $100 with you, and you bring $20,000, you did what I asked you to do, right?
Yes.
So, you know, but you did it to excess. So some of those nails that are made out of recycled material are incredibly hard. I've seen 60-penny nails, which are smaller in diameter and length than the red nail, that are a lot harder to bend than a red nail. So I got some that were easier and some that were harder, and I would spend a couple of days bending anywhere from 6 to 15 of the easy nails, and then I would spend one day a week bending between 3 and 8 of the harder nails. And just over time, I got to where I was able to bend the harder nails easier. The next step above the 60-penny nail is a grade 5 bolt. And sometimes they're hot rolled, sometimes they're cold rolled. So you've got to be careful because some of them are springy and some of them aren't. And you can tell after you bend one, if the bend is very sharp and pointy, the angle at which it bends, it's going to be easier to bend than if you bend it and it's more U-shaped. That's a springier kind of steel, and it'll be harder to bend.
All right.
But go get Jed's book. It explains there's a lot of assistance exercises and stuff that I don't really do because I haven't, you know, focused solely on bending. And Jed knows more about bending than me, so do what he says.
Awesome. All right, next one is Steve Matthews says, Dave, thanks for doing this. We'd like to know your thoughts about carryover from the heavy bent press to other lifts.
The heavy bent press carryover to other lifts, there's a tremendous amount of it because the bent press involves, it's a full body lift. It also involves a lot of mobility and flexibility under tension that carries over not just to other lifts but to other athletic type stuff. When you're in the bottom of the bent press, it's a lot like being in the bottom of a windmill, except the weight that you've got overhead is heavier than anything you could do in a windmill if you're doing a very heavy bent press. Bent press will allow you to get more weight overhead with one hand than any other lift. So, but at the same time, you have to earn the right to put that much weight overhead with one hand, because if you don't, then at best you will drop the weight on the ground. At worst, you'll drop it through your floor on your head and probably wrench something as you do it. So make sure not to neglect your get-ups and your windmills as you're working towards your bent press. Get your thoracic spine mobility going, work your military presses, get your shoulders nice and strong, and then work on that technique with the lats. In my Full Body Power DVD, I do the I have a correction or a teaching method on there where I use a dog leash with the bent press. You kind of put the loop around one hand and run it across your back and across your butt to the opposite foot and stand on it, and the leash doesn't move, and it forces you to keep your hand still. That's the biggest mistake I see people making with the bent press, is they'll get almost to lockout, and then they'll start pressing with their arm, and they'll lose the whole thing. The bent press, the weight should stay at about the same height. So the carryover there, shoulder flexibility, strength in a compromised position, a lot of activity going on in the midsection, and in being able to stand up with a heavy weight overhead from a really bizarre angle. So a lot of carryover. I love the bent press.
I can tell.
It's a cool thing to do if you're like out at a bar and you want to lift a girl over your head with one hand and she's a little portly. Or she's not. It looks dangerous, even though it's not. It's a really, really safe way to do it. But because very few people lift stuff overhead with one hand, and because very few people fold at the waist while they're doing it, or fold at the hips while they're doing it, it looks unusual to people. So it's a very visually entertaining lift.
I can definitely see it impressing people at a bar for sure.
Yeah.
Next one, David asks, what supplements do you recommend?
Steak.
Steak.
That's really, I don't do a whole lot of supplement. If I do supplements, it's because I don't feel like I've managed to get enough out of whatever food was available that day. I like fish oil and essential fatty acids. I like protein powder because sometimes it's tough to eat the amount of protein from a natural animal source or from a dairy source that is needed to do the kind of stuff that I do. So I like protein powder. I like ProGrade brand. I've got links on my website that'll take you to that. It's a brand that's available only through people who are in the fitness business. You can't get it in stores, but they make a product called ProGrade Lean that's a really, really tasty meal replacement type thing.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's pretty much all I do. I've used creatine before, and I believe it works. And I'm just not really interested in getting any bigger. I think that it made me bigger, and it probably helped in getting stronger. But the kind of strength that comes with getting bigger is not the kind of strength that I'm chasing right now. So I believe creatine works. Anything else like nitrous oxide or NO2, whatever that stuff, I think that you'd be better off just buying steak.
Alright, next one comes from Anthony. He asks, when it comes to odd feats of strength, is there anything you won't try? Why or why not?
Is there anything that I won't try? No, not that I can think of. There is something that I'm not willing to try. My friend Mike the Machine Bruce has the strongest neck in the world, and he does feats with his neck that I will never do. I've seen him hang himself before, and I'm not going to do that because I just don't want to. And also, we've done shows together where I've stood behind him with a 5/8-inch, 4-foot-long bar and bent it across his throat. And I will never let anybody bend a bar across my throat for a couple of reasons. One, that's kind of Mike's thing, and I don't want to be like Mike. And the other thing is I've asked Mike, and he tells me it hurts a lot, and I've seen him spend the rest of the evening kind of having to clear his throat because he had so much pressure on his trachea, and I'm just not interested in doing that particular feat. But it's an impressive thing if you ever get a chance to see him do it, especially if I'm the one pulling on the bar, because talking about that whole shut the pain off thing earlier, even more difficult than shutting the pain off for yourself is being willing to just unload on your friend and do something that might kill him. It took me probably 7 or 8 times of bending the bar across his throat to get to the point to where I know that I'm not going to hurt him. And I can just explode on it now and really hit the bar with everything I've got because I know his neck can take everything that I've got. And it's an impressive feat to see
that.
Because he holds his arms out to the side like a crucifix and exhales when he does it, and his head turns all red and bald, and it's really scary. And then you've got me back there cranking on this bar like I'm trying to wrap it around his face. And it's a cool feat. If you ever get a chance to see Mike the Machine do his thing, he's a really good strong man.
What's your favorite one to do?
Right now, things come in seasons, and I cycle through things a lot. Right now, my favorite thing to do is bending horseshoes because I've been spending a lot of time working on that lately. A big fan of the horseshoe. I like tearing cards a lot. I like from a kettlebell standpoint, I like doing the bottoms up stuff, and one of the ones that has kind of turned into a signature thing for me is the pinky press, which I don't spend a whole lot of time practicing that particular thing because it hurts a lot, but I do train my pinkies with like a jump stretch band type stuff. I do a lot of low weight, high rep stuff with the pinky. But the pinky press with the kettlebell just hurts a lot. So I don't really practice it that much. I do it in shows.
We'll do one more question here. Doug Descant asks, what advice would you give a person who has a good foundation in kettlebell techniques and has 5 months to prepare for the RKC certification?
Okay, repeat that for me one more time.
What advice would you give a person who has a solid foundation in kettlebell techniques and has 5 months to prepare for the RKC certification?
Work on... My best advice is to over-prepare, be ready with... at level one RKC, we teach 6 foundational drills. We teach the swing, the get up, the clean, the squat, the snatch, and the press. Work on those. Everyone who goes to RKC before they get there stresses out about the snatch test. They're worried about their snatch test, worried about their snatch test. The snatch test is the least of your worries. The main thing you need to be ready for is an insane amount of volume over the course of 3 days, and do everything you can to take care of your hands and to get your technique dialed in enough, and to get the conditioning of the skin of your hands dialed in enough that you're not ripping your palms to pieces, because that's the biggest complaint that people have, is they come in and just through the amount of volume that we have and the fact that they don't have perfect technique when they get there, they wind up tearing their palms up. Do a lot of swings. Do a lot of swings. Be ready to go from 9 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night for 2.5 days.
Do you recommend a lot more eating prior to that or anything? That's a ton of volume over 3 days. I'm just curious how the structure of the days out there with your eating and stuff like that.
Eat as much as you can, as often as you can while you're out there. We break for lunch, and so eat a big breakfast, carry some food out on the field with you. He said he had a solid foundation in kettlebell training. I'm going to assume that he's met with somebody and learned how to do this stuff. But if you're not sure, find an RKC and learn the way we do things before you go. And go in with a good attitude. Go in ready to learn, because I've seen people come in who have decided they're going to show us what they've got, and they're always the people who fail to bring anything. The people who come and do really well are the people who come in with an attitude of wanting to learn and wanting to be a part of what we do. And so we welcome those people. We welcome everybody, but it's up to you to decide what kind of experience you're going to have. Just do a lot of swings, dude, a lot of swings and a lot of get-ups. If you need a short answer to that, then follow the rite of passage. Everything else we'll teach you when you get there.
Good stuff. And tell us a little about you have a couple products. Tell us a little bit about your Full Body Power DVD.
DVD is I call it Full Body Power Beyond the Basics, and it's kind of my take on stringing together foundational movements into longer complexes, but a little bit differently than a lot of people do stuff with complexes. It's a couple of years old, and some of the stuff that's on there I've kind of refined and don't really do it that way anymore, but I'm probably going to shoot Full Body Power Volume 2 later on this year. But it's about doing complex-type combination movements in ways that nobody had thought of, or at least nobody had put a product on the market. It's kind of just my way of thinking of doing those things at that point in time. There's in my opinion, probably the best bent press tutorial that's on the market on video. Not that I'm so much better than anybody else at doing that. It's just that nobody else has really gone into that as much detail with the bent press as I do on that video, just because it hadn't happened yet when I did that video. So I'm really pleased with the bent press section on that. I talk about the two ends anyhow. I talk about a few different press variations. I think it's a good video. It was shot during a workshop, so I have people there who are learning the moves, and they're making the mistakes that a lot of people make, and so you're able to see real-time corrections of a mistake that you might make if you buy the video. And it's available at fullbodypower.com.
All right. Another question. This is, who do you recommend for like mentors and other guys to follow as far as their training styles and, you know, so people don't get stuck into one frame of mind? Who do you recommend? Like, who do you follow and look up to and kind of your mentors?
Obviously, Pavel, because the whole thing with the RKC kind of reshaped the way I think about things. I'm a big fan of Dan John. I think that his approach is very just sensible. It just makes sense. When Dan John talks, it's hard to argue with anything he says because any objection that you might have is countered in before you can ever come up with it. Mark Rifkin is another one who's like that. I'm a big fan of Alan Cosgrove. I think that the simplicity of his delivery is a good balance to the insane amount of science that the guy knows. He understands human movement. He understands the physiology, and he's able to articulate it very, very well. And he understands the psychology behind doing things, which he's been a big help to me. I'm a fan of Charles Staley. I like kind of the logical approach that he takes with stuff, too. Obviously, Dennis Rogers, one of the best strongmen that's ever been around. My buddy Zach Evanesh. Zach has some good stuff, too. I'm a big fan of Kenneth J. Within the RKC community, Kenneth J. and a guy who doesn't really have any products out is Jeff O'Connor. But I talk to Jeff 4 or 5 times a week. Anytime I have a training question, he's usually the first person that I ask. And Brett Jones and Gray Cook with the functional movement screen stuff, because they're able to – they helped me to – take a knee that was going bad and realize that it wasn't my knee, that it was my hip, and do stuff to correct it. So now my knee doesn't bother me anymore.
That's always a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's gonna wrap it up, Dave. I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, and Jed and Smitty from Diesel Crew. I would be remiss without talking about them because they helped me.
Oh, yeah.
And Adam Glass. Adam Glass knows a lot about destroying stuff, too.
A lot of those guys, I've actually got those that I've joined up recently onto my list and signed up for this call. There's a Cosgrove interview that you'll be getting if you haven't got it already.
Mm-hmm.
And Smitty will be, I think, in like 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of – I'm trying to get everybody I can for the interviews as well.
Yeah, it's excellent.
So, and excellent. I wouldn't recommend listening to Cosgrove if you don't like cuss words.
Yeah. If I had to distill it down to two different ants or three different people, it'd be Dennis Rogers, Cosgrove. But Pavel is so important to everything that I do that he's 1 through 5 of the top 10 list. Because if it weren't for Pavel, we wouldn't be talking right now. Nobody in this country would know what a kettlebell is. He's the father of the whole kettlebell movement, and the RKC is. You know, the root of any kettlebell certification that we have right now in the Western world anyway. Everybody who's doing it was involved in the RKC in some capacity along the way. So I choose to stick to the source.
Definitely. And one more time, what were the main sites that I know you said fullbodypower.com for people that wanted to purchase your DVD, but where else can they check out your work and what you have going on, Dave?
My main website is irontamer.com. And I'm actually, Rocco Castellano is redoing that site as we speak. So it should be completely redone here in a couple of days. My local site for Nashville is NashvilleKettlebell.com. And then I have a blog that's tied into each one of those sites. And they're cleverly named NashvilleKettlebellBlog.com and IronTamerBlog.com. But the main site is IronTamer.com, and you can pretty well link off to anything else that I've got going on from that site. It's kind of the hub site. I usually keep an updated schedule of workshops and appearances that I'm going to be doing, and Which that it stands to. I need to throw this plug out there too. I am available for strongman performances and workshops. So if anybody is interested in bringing the tamer to your town, then shoot me an email and I will come and lift kettlebells with you and help you move better and destroy stuff and eat beef with you.
Awesome. Well, once again, Dave, I want to thank you again for taking the time. I hope everybody on the call and all the ones that, if we didn't get to your question, you can shoot either me or Dave an email, and we'll try to get that answered for you. But we've gone now for almost 2 hours, so. But
yeah, and if you like the call, I appreciate it, and tell everybody about it. If you didn't like it, just shut up and don't say nothing to anybody.
Awesome. And once again, this is Ryan McGee with MuscleGainingExperts.com and Dave Whitley from IronTamer.com. Thanks again, Dave, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate it. Good night, everybody.
Good night, guys.